Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
President Obama says the truth on the downed Malaysian plane must come out, and Kerry and Bond head to the Mideast. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama says Russia must do its part to pressure pro-Russian separatists to allow international access to the downed Malaysian airliner in Ukraine. In remarks at the White House, Mr. Obama said the truth must come out and international teams must be allowed access to the crash site, which has been blocked by separatists. In characterizing the militants' actions, President Obama asked, what are they trying to hide?
Our immediate focus is on recovering those who were lost, investigating exactly what happened, and putting forward the facts. We have to make sure that the truth is out.
The president said the pro-Russian separatists are also tampering with the crash site and removing bodies without care, calling their actions an insult to those who have lost loved ones on MH17. Meanwhile, there is growing international anger at the separatists for trampling over the crash site and the slow pace of international access to the victims. European leaders said today they were ready to slap increasing sanctions on Russia to force Moscow to use its influence over the rebels to stop the conflict and allow international investigators free access to the crash site. British Prime Minister David Cameron told Parliament today that Russia cannot expect to enjoy access to European markets and money if it fuels conflict in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk has offered to turn over the lead in the investigation into the downing of the Malaysian airliner to the Netherlands, the country that suffered the most losses in the disaster. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council will vote this afternoon on a resolution demanding international access to the crash site. United Nations Chief Ban Ki-moon and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry are heading to Cairo in a new attempt to mediate a ceasefire in the two-week-old clash between Israel and Hamas militants in Gaza. VOA's Scott Bob reports.
Sirens sounded in Israel's largest city, and residents took cover as Israeli forces said they intercepted two rockets from Gaza. Palestinian health officials said the death toll in Gaza surpassed 500 people overnight as Israeli forces continued to attack tunnels and rocket launching sites controlled by the Hamas group and allied militants. The Israeli military said its forces killed at least 10 Palestinian fighters Monday after they crossed into Israel through two tunnels. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Delegates to the 20th International AIDS Conference assembled in Melbourne, Australia today for the first full day of speeches, seminars, and meetings to examine the current state of AIDS research. About 12,000 delegates, including scientists and activists, as well as people living with the disease, will meet through Friday to discuss community responses to the disease and ways to accelerate prevention and treatment. The International AIDS Society president called for a moment of silence at the opening ceremony Sunday evening to pay tribute to six delegates who were on the Malaysia Airlines flight that was shot down over Ukraine last week, killing all 298 on board. A prominent Dutch researcher and former president of the International AIDS Society, Jop Lange, and the World Health Organization spokesman, Glenn Thomas, were among the victims. U.S. President Barack Obama has signed two executive orders to prohibit discrimination against gay and transgender government workers as gay rights supporters cheered at the White House ceremony today. Mr. Obama said he firmly believes it's time to curb workplace discrimination against gays. Mr. Obama's orders will impact 24,000 companies that employ 28 million workers, or about one-fifth of the U.S. workforce. A report from the United Nations Nuclear Agency says Iran has converted or diluted its stockpile of highly enriched uranium as called for an agreement the country reached with a group of six world powers last November. The report from the International Atomic Energy Agency said Iran's more than 200-kilogram stockpile of uranium enriched to 20% has been turned into harmless forms. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Everyone at this year's AIDS conference agrees on one basic goal: eradicating the deadly virus. But on the sidelines of the meeting, experts and activists have vastly different visions for how to get there.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia. We'll have full details on this story and other AIDS-related stories coming up. Also in the news, Libyan security officials say rocket and mortar attacks at the Tripoli airport resumed yesterday. A new study shows circumcision can greatly reduce men's risk of being infected with the AIDS virus. And the FAO warns West African countries about the link between eating wildlife and Ebola. We'll have these stories plus sports with Peter Clotie sitting in for the vacationing Sonny Young, music from Sudan, and part one of our VOA Presents special series on the International AIDS Conference. Stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour: Libyan security officials say rocket and mortar attacks at the Tripoli airport resumed yesterday as fighting grew more intense between rival militias seeking control of the airport. Fighters from the city of Zintan clashed with Islamist-led militias from Misrata. Four deaths were reported, two were civilians. The airport has been closed since July 12th when rocket attacks destroyed most of the civilian aircraft and damaged the terminal and control tower. The attack shut down all flights in the region. More than 50 have died in fighting that in and around the international airport. The United Nations pulled all staff out of Libya after missiles struck the airport a week ago. Last Thursday, Foreign Minister Mohamed Abdelaziz requested UN help to build up Libya's army and police force and protect airport and oil installations. Government authority has been seriously weakened in Libya since militias defeated the regime of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Islamists control significant regions of eastern Libya and its oil exporting ports. Everyone at the 20th International AIDS Conference agrees on one basic goal: eradicating the deadly virus. But as Anita Powell found out on the sidelines of the meeting, experts and activists have very different visions on how to get there. She reports from Melbourne, Australia.
AIDS is often called the world's smartest disease. Once inside a host, the 9-gene retrovirus replicates with uncanny speed, yet changes tack suddenly whenever the immune system tries to challenge it. The virus, which under a microscope looks like a little ball covered with spikes, has outwitted some of the world's greatest scientists, who have yet to find a cure more than 30 years after the virus was first recognized. The UN's AIDS organization says that in that time, AIDS has killed a staggering 39 million people worldwide. And so, as some 12,000 delegates, among them scientists, activists, and people living with HIV and AIDS, meet this week in Melbourne, everyone seems to have a different plan for neutralizing the virus that attacks on so many fronts. Many, like Nahat Al-Hadi of the Sudan Family Planning Association, have a simple wish from this conference.
Ending new infection, HIV/AIDS new infection. All the science, all the posters, all the presentation come on and work together to end new infections.
Others, like the head of UNAIDS, Michelle Sidibe, have a detailed step-by-step plan, which he outlined at the conference's opening ceremony.
My vision for ending AIDS looks like this: voluntary testing and treatment reaching everyone everywhere. Each person with HIV reaching viral suppression. No one dies from AIDS or is born with HIV. People living with HIV live with dignity, protected by laws, and free to move anywhere in the world.
But as many activists point out, medicine is not the only route. Society plays a powerful role in the fight against AIDS, especially in societies where gays, lesbians, transgendered, and intersex citizens are ostracized or criminalized. This conference has made special note of that issue in its declaration, calling for an end to discrimination against those who are different. Abina Aher is one such person. She was born with a male name. She now lives as a Hijra, a person who is neither fully male nor fully female, in her native India, though she publicly identifies as female. Because Hijras are ostracized, she says, they often resort to sex work to survive, which in turn leads to a huge risk of AIDS. She says she sees a huge gap in the medical approach. If, she says, a person is so depressed that he does not care if he lives or dies, how can he be protected against HIV?
My priority is not HIV. My priority is feminization. My priority is social support. My priority is mental health. When you design an HIV program, you cannot keep away all these things out of that.
Researcher Kylie Johnston of the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society agrees.
I think the most important thing for me is that community doesn't get lost in the biomedical, because I think they have a lot to contribute still to the fight, and also we can get sort of caught up in the science and the excitement of things like the cure and, treatment as prevention, but I think we need to make sure that community is still involved.
On the conference's first full day, Monday, there were 87 different scheduled events, and that does not include side events or exhibitions. It's a lot to think about, especially considering that somewhere in that enormous mental haystack, there may be that cure that everyone so desperately wants. Anita Powell, VOA News, Melbourne, Australia.
Thank you, Anita. A new study that could boost HIV prevention efforts says African men do not engage in riskier sexual behavior after being circumcised. Research has shown that circumcision can greatly reduce men's risk of being infected with the AIDS virus. The study has been released as the 20th International AIDS Conference opens in Melbourne, Australia. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The study was done in Kenya's Nyanza province, a region where male circumcision is not common. Nellie Westerkamp is the study's principal investigator and lead author.
The connection between male circumcision and HIV has been detected in a number of observational studies since 1990s. However, the scientific inquiry on this topic culminated when three clinical control trials in Kenya, Uganda, and South Africa found that male circumcision reduces the risk of female to male transmission by about 60%.
Despite the risk reduction, Westerkamp says male circumcision should not be used alone to prevent HIV infection.
It's supposed to be implemented as a package of interventions altogether: male circumcision, condom promotion, HIV testing and counseling, and so on.
Some fear that if circumcision was promoted as a prevention measure, circumcised men might think it was all right to engage in risky sexual behavior.
If men who become circumcised believe that they're fully protected against HIV and engage in higher sexual risk-taking behaviors as a result of this belief, this could reduce or even negate the protective effect of male circumcision against HIV.
Between 2008 and 2010, nearly 3,200 uncircumcised men from Nyanza province took part in the study. Half underwent medical circumcision, while the other half did not. At the beginning of the study, those who chose to have the procedure actually thought they would be at greater risk of infection than those who chose not to have it done. That perception declined significantly over time. Researchers then monitored the participants. Westerkamp says fears of increased risky sexual behavior among circumcised men were unfounded.
Looking at sexual behaviors, we saw that the overall level of sexual activity increased equally in both groups, mostly driven by the youngest age group, that's 18 to 24-year-olds. However, despite this decrease in the risk perception among circumcised men and the increase in sexual activity in both groups, all other risk behaviors decreased in both groups, and some protective behaviors, such as condom use, increased, particularly among circumcised men.
Westerkamp says countries that have been holding back on implementing medical circumcision programs should have no concerns about scaling up those programs. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The world's top producer of platinum announced today that it will sell two of its mines in South Africa. That follows a five-month strike by more than 80,000 mine workers. Anglo-American Platinum LLC announced it was pulling out of its operations in Pandora and Rustenburg mines. The company said it could mean the loss of 20,000 jobs. The company said these are its oldest and lowest producing operations. Members of the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union won a $95 a month wage increase in the June settlement. But mining companies suffered a 40% loss in platinum production during the lengthy strike. The Food and Agriculture Organization is warning West African countries about the link between eating wildlife and Ebola. Among the animals of particular concern is the fruit bat. More than 600 people are believed to have died from the disease in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone over the past 4 months. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Ebola epidemic in West Africa is the deadliest recorded outbreak of the disease. The FAO says it probably started when the Ebola virus crossed over from infected wildlife to the human population. From there, it spread person to person through direct contact with the blood or body fluids of infected people. FAO Chief Veterinary Officer Juan LeBroth says it's important to understand how the virus behaves in its normal cycle in the forest.
When we, as humans, go into the forest, either for hunting or gathering food, first animal we encounter could be weak or ill, and then we bring it back to our village, there's some risk there of bringing back, in this particular case, maybe an Ebola-affected animal.
The bushmeat is then brought back to the village, where infection could occur.
You could have transmission to humans, either the hunter who is dressing the animal, cleaning it for food preparation, or other villagers that may be involved with the food preparation, including women. And there you have that transmission of the virus to the human population.
If a person becomes ill and goes to a medical center, he or she could infect doctors or nurses. The initial symptoms of Ebola may take about 2 weeks to appear and begin with only a fever.
If this happens in an urban population, in an urban setting, well, then the human-to-human contact rate is greater and disease can spill over.
LeBroth says despite the risk, it's not realistic to suggest people stop hunting altogether. Attempts to ban the sale or consumption of bushmeat have been met with suspicion in local communities. He adds, however, that communities need clear advice about not touching dead animals and not selling or eating the meat of any animal found dead. The Food and Agriculture Organization says fruit bats are often eaten dried or in a spicy soup. They are thought to be the most likely reservoir for the virus. Fruit bats can carry the virus without showing any clinical symptoms. Adding to the spread of Ebola in West Africa is mistrust of medical workers. Some are actually hiding infected people instead of getting them help. Fear has also affected farmers, many of whom are now too afraid to work their fields. Some markets have also closed as a result. This could eventually have an effect on food security. The FAO will help governments in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone launch wildlife surveillance programs. They would be used as early warning systems for Ebola. The UN agency also plans to help communities establish long-term livestock production to reduce the reliance on bushmeat. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The homes and businesses of thousands of poor people living on Liberia's coast are being swept away by rising sea levels. Liberia's Environmental Protection Agency says a project is underway to help stop the erosion, but that there is not enough funding. Jennifer Lazuta has more from our West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
Hundreds of coastal communities in Liberia are being destroyed by sea erosion. Residents say they are left homeless as rising sea levels continue to wash away their houses and shops. Joe Muffer lives in Grambassa County's Buchanan City, one of several areas that have been badly affected by the erosion.
the situation is terrible. The sea erosion has taken away our homes, and right now we have to. I have to relocate my family to the to an abandoned school building because, as you can see, the sea erosion is still. It's still tough. The sea is rising every day, every moment, but we are in dire need of help right now.
Liberia's Environmental Protection Agency is aware of the problems the rising sea levels are causing and has been working to control the erosion. Stephen Y. Nufville is the Deputy Executive Director of the EPA.
The first phase of the project is all going. There has been some drawbacks. But we are responding to the impact of the sea encroaching on the city, and therefore putting borders and other things to minimize the impact.
Nufville said the Ministry of Lands, Mines, and Energy has spent $6 million on various projects throughout the country to reduce the negative effects of climate change, including sea erosion. He said $2.4 million is being spent on the ongoing Phase 1, which is constructing offshore seawalls to help stop the waves from further eroding the shore. But Liberia's Steering Committee on Sea Erosion estimates that at least $18 million will be needed to complete the project. Residents, meanwhile, have been building protective sandbag barriers in front of their homes to keep the seawater at bay. But for many, this has not been enough. Tom O'Kay, who lost his home to the ocean earlier this year, said that more needs to be done to help both the victims and those still at risk.
Anywhere to go, and then we're asking our local government, our international government and partners to see how well they can help government to help us. Houses have been around for years, so we don't know, and right now government is not finding money anywhere, so we're discouraged, we don't know what to do, we don't know where to start from because we're in between the seasons.
Authorities say they have tried to get people living in the most vulnerable areas to relocate, but most refuse to leave because the government is unable to offer resettlement packages. Nufville said residents who have been forcibly removed often return to rebuild or else settle illegally in neighboring high-risk zones.
People have to be mindful where you construct your building. You need to get the necessary permits, and we stop people from building in the waterways, encroaching on the drainages, the existing drainages, and nobody pay attention.
Nufville said the EPA continues to meet to discuss new strategies for fighting sea erosion, as well as search for more funding. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
Ukraine has offered to give the lead in the investigation into the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner last Thursday to the Netherlands, the country that had the most citizens on board. The offer came as three forensic investigators from the Netherlands arrived on the scene in eastern Ukraine, the first foreign experts to get there. VOA's Al Pessin reports from Kiev.
The Ukrainian offer appears to be aimed at convincing Russia and the rebels it supports to allow the transport of the 272 bodies found so far, most of them waiting in refrigerated rail cars in a rebel-controlled town. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk announced it at a news conference in Kiev.
Ukrainian government is ready to transfer an international investigation to our Dutch friends. Dutch side could lead the process of investigation together with the entire international community and Ukrainian authorities.
The proposal could break a deadlock that has left the bodies stranded in the town of Torez. Russian-backed separatists who control the area have refused Ukrainian and international requests to allow the train to travel to the government-controlled city of Kharkiv, 300 kilometers away. Yatsenyuk said 28 investigators from four countries and three Australian diplomats arrived in Kharkiv Monday morning to receive the bodies and arrange for their transport to a forensic laboratory in Amsterdam. He said that would provide for a more independent investigation. Meanwhile, the three Dutch forensic investigators arrived at the crash site and are working with a delegation from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. That delegation is on a human rights mission, but diverted to the crash area last week and has been documenting the situation. Its spokesman, Michael Butsurkiv, described the experts' initial efforts at the rural station where the railroad cars are parked.
The three cars with the body bags were open. They stepped inside the three cars. They had a flashlight. They had a quick look around, and they said that they were more or less pleased with the way the body bags are stacked and the temperature under difficult conditions.
But Zyrkiev said it took the investigators a day and a half to reach the area by road. The government says it's not launching any offensives near the crash site, but there were reports of fighting in the regional capital, Donetsk, 80 kilometers away. And Michael Butzyrkiev says there are reports the rail line may be damaged, which could further complicate the questions of where the bodies will be sent and when. At the news conference, Prime Minister Yatsenyuk showed anger and emotion and used strong language, describing the separatists as drunks and bastards and saying Russia is on the dark side.
Together with the entire international community, we will bring to justice everyone responsible, including the country which is behind the scene.
Mr. Yatsenyuk said Russia is supplying, training, and financing the separatists. He called on Russia to stop, saying enough is enough. But he said he does not expect Russia to cooperate now after months of supporting the rebels and days of no help with the crash investigation. Aside from the issue of the bodies, Mr. Yatsenyuk called for the handover of all evidence collected in the area where the plane went down. Some of it was collected by locally based workers from Ukraine's State Emergency Service, but other material, including the plane's flight recorders, is believed to be in the hands of the separatists. Officials say the qualified emergency workers are doing their jobs as best they can, but their activities are controlled by the separatists. Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur went down last Thursday with 298 people on board. Western intelligence agencies say the plane was almost certainly shot down by a Russian-made anti-aircraft missile fired from a mobile launcher parked in a rebel-controlled area. They say their sensors detected a missile launch and that three such systems were seen being driven back into Russia shortly after the attack. Russia's military said on Monday it did not detect any missile launches in the area and alleged that a Ukrainian fighter jet was flying 3 to 5 kilometers from the Malaysian plane. Russia also denied supplying any weapon systems to the rebels. Pro-Russian militants initially boasted online about shooting down a Ukrainian military transport plane last week, but then removed the post. And the Ukrainian government has published audio recordings it says are the voices of shocked rebels arriving on the scene and finding the remains of the civilian airliner and its passengers and reporting the fact to Russian operatives. Al Pessin, VOA News, Kiev.
This is African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move, don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah, now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent
to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Libyan security officials say rocket and mortar attacks at the Tripoli airport resumed yesterday as fighting grew more intense between rival militias seeking control of the airport. And experts and activists at the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia, have very different visions on how to eradicate HIV/AIDS. Coming up, we have music from Sudan, and we begin a new feature series on VOA Presents, the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Peter Cloete sitting in today for Sunny Young, who is on vacation this week. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Kim.
Well, I understand there's big soccer news today.
Indeed. Steven Gerrard, after 14 long years, decided to quit international football.
Wow, tell us all about it.
Well, I will. Steven Gerrard, the English national team captain and captain of English top club side Liverpool, has decided to retire from international football after 14 years representing the senior national side. Gerrard led the English squad to the World Cup in Brazil, where the team failed to progress from the group stage of the competition. Speaking on the FA website, Steven Gerrard said, "I have enjoyed every minute of representing my country, and it is a sad day for me knowing that I won't pull on the England shirt again. However, I do look forward to continuing my strong relationship with the FA and helping out in any way I can going forward." Meanwhile, Wayne Rooney, another English international and striker for Manchester United Football Club, said he wants to impress his new coach, Louis van Gaal, during the club's pre-season trip to the United States. Rooney says, "We have to show him every day in training what different qualities we have got as players and a team. Everyone wants to impress the new manager so that it is what we all aiming to do." Brazil's Football Federation plans to name a new coach on Tuesday to replace Felipe Scolari after Big Phil, as he is affectionately referred to by his teaming supporters, resigned as manager of the Brazilian senior national team. The team's humiliating 7-1 defeat to eventual World Cup winners Germany and another loss to the Netherlands forced Scolari to resign after saying the defeat to Germany was the saddest day in his entire life. The German national team apparently celebrated their fourth World Cup title a bit too hard last weekend, according to the president of the German Football Federation, Wolfgang Niersbach. Part of the World Cup trophy was damaged at the Rio after party. Niersbach told German news magazine Spiegel, "At one spot, a small piece was chipped off, but don't worry, we have specialists who can fix it." The culprit? A mystery. Niersbach joked that a thorough and persistent investigation was conducted, but proved inconclusive.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Welcome back. And in the transfer market, La Liga giants Real Madrid have reportedly secured the signature of Colombian international James Rodriguez, who was a world-class revelation at the FIFA World Cup hosted by Brazil. Rodriguez, who was signed from French Ligue 1 side Monaco, will team up with Gareth Bale and the world's current Footballer of the Year, Cristiano Ronaldo, in Real Madrid's star-studded attack. English side Chelsea are reportedly in talks with Ivorian captain and club legend Didier Drogba. Drogba is currently a free agent after leaving Galatasaray. He left Stamford Bridge in 2012 after scoring the winning penalty in the Champions League final against Bayern Munich. Drogba's advisors say a decision has not yet been made and that Chelsea is one of a number of options. But talks are underway and the 36-year-old is likely to decide on a possible return this week. Patrice Evra has completed his move from Manchester United to Juventus. The French left-back has been at Old Trafford since 2006. Evra says deciding to leave Manchester United is, quote, the biggest decision of my career. The Frenchman, who joined the club from Monaco in January 2006, made 379 appearances and scored 10 goals during 9 seasons at Old Trafford. He says, after a great deal of thought, I have decided the time is right for me to leave Manchester United. It is the biggest decision of my career, as this club is and will always remain in my heart. Tottenham have opened talks with Swansea goalkeeper Michel Vorm over a potential move to White Hart Lane. The 30-year-old Netherlands international has been granted permission to speak to Spurs via his representative after the Premier League clubs agreed a fee over the weekend thought to be in the region of $9 million. The proposed deal is complex and dependent to an extent on a separate agreement for left-back Ben Davies to join Spurs and for midfielder Guy-Phil Sigurdsson to move in the opposite direction. Negotiations concerning all transfers are thought to be going well, but Vorm has reservations about how much playing time he will get in competition with current Tottenham Hotspur and France number one Hugo Lloris. The 27-year-old Lloris recently signed a new 5-year deal at Spurs, but Europe's top clubs are becoming increasingly keen to have top two-class goalkeepers battling it out for the number one spot, and Tottenham are no exception. And with the 2014 World Cup in Brazil now over, the qualifiers of the 2015 African Cup of Nations qualifiers resumed over the weekend. For details of results over the matches and other sports news roundup, here's Nightline Africa sports editor Segun Adeyemi from Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos, with more.
In the first round of the third stage of the qualifiers, Uganda, Botswana and Sierra Leone scored impressive victories that may serve them well in the return leg matches in a fortnight. All three won their matches by the same 2-0 scoreline. Uganda beat visiting Mauritania, Botswana playing at home defeated Guinea-Bissau, while Sierra Leone utilized home advantage to beat Seychelles. Four more matches are slated for today, Sunday. The aggregate winners of the two-leg third stage will advance to the final qualifying round, which is the group stage, to join the 21 teams that have already drawn a bye into that stage. The group stage comprises 28 teams drawn into 7 groups of 4 teams each. Group stage qualifiers will kick off in September, with the top 2 in each group plus the best third-place team qualifying for the finals. Host Morocco is an automatic qualifier. Talking about the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, watching the World Cup in Brazil has convinced the football stars of Kenya that it can qualify for the 2015 tournament in Morocco. Kenya, which is famous for its athletes, has not featured at the Continental Football Showpiece since making a first-round exit 10 years ago. But goalkeeper Jeremy Onyango of the Harambee Stars, as the Kenyan team is known, believes that is about to change. Onyango was among the 16 players and 4 coaches who traveled to Brazil thanks to the generosity of President Uhuru Kenyatta. The head of state told the national team he would bankroll a visit to the World Cup after they won the regional CECAFA Challenge Cup last December. Onyango told Kenyan reporters that the trip was an eye-opener for him and his teammates. Seeing is believing. We watch the stars from the stands and realize they do not possess extraordinary skills that we lack. We only need to believe in ourselves, and we will do well in the Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers, he says. Should Kenya eliminate Lesotho in a two-leg tie, it will join 2013 Africa Cup runners-up Burkina Faso, Angola and Gabon for the group stage. The 6-match group phase kicks off in September and will last 3 months. As I reported earlier, the top 2 finishers, and the third best placed team are guaranteed places at the tournament. Back here in Nigeria, the country's under-20 women's national team, nicknamed the Falconets, are now gearing up for the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup, starting on August 5th in Canada. Also, the country still remains on course for the CAF Under-17 Championship, as its qualifier against Rwanda, earlier set for this weekend, has already been shifted to July 27th. Nigeria is back in reckoning for the tournaments because World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, has lifted the suspension it imposed on the Nigeria Football Federation, NFF, due to government interference in sports. The suspension from international football was lifted on Friday. A FIFA statement said the Global Federation has noted that the court proceedings and order preventing the president of the NFF, the NFF Executive Committee members, and the NFF Congress from running the affairs of Nigerian football have been withdrawn. As statutory order has been reinstated at the NFF and the legitimate bodies reinstalled, FIFA has decided to lift the suspension, the statement said. Nigeria's reinstatement comes after a reversal of the decision to remove senior members of the NFF following allegations of corruption. Africa's other representative at the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup, Ghana, has already landed in Canada to continue with preparations for the competition. Ghana is in Group A with host Canada, Finland, and former champion North Korea. The Black Princesses, as the Ghana team is known, and the host will play in the tournament's opening match at Toronto's National Stadium. For its part, Nigeria is in the same group as England, South Korea, and Mexico. Nigeria opens its campaign against Mexico on August 6th. Let's recall that while Nigeria remains suspended, South Africa made a bid to replace the country at the FIFA tournament, sending a delegation led by President of the South African Football Association, Danny Jordan, to FIFA. In more African football news, host Namibia has been drawn into a tough group that includes perennial winner Nigeria for the 2014 African Women's Championship to be held from October 11th to 25th. According to the draw, conducted in the Namibian capital, Windhoek, on Saturday, Ivory Coast and debutant Zambia are also in the same Group A as Namibia and Nigeria. Group B comprises South Africa, Cameroon, Algeria, and Ghana. The 2014 African Women's Championship is also a qualification tournament for the 2015 African Women's World Cup, with the top three qualifying for the finals in Canada. The tournament marks the first time that host Namibia will feature in the African Championship. Nigeria has won all but two editions of the two-yearly tournament since it started in 1998. Equatorial Guinea is the only other winner. And former Lorient coach Christian Gourcuff has succeeded Vahid Halilhodžić as coach of Algeria. The Algerian Football Federation has announced Gourcuff has been handed a contract leading up to the 2018 World Cup in Russia, with a more immediate target being the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations in Morocco. Halilhodžić stood down after leading Algeria to the last 16 at the World Cup for the first time in Brazil.
That was Segun Adeyemi, sports editor for Nightline Africa Sports, reporting from Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos. Well, folks, that's about all time will permit us for today on the sunny side of sports. I'm Peter Clotty, sitting in for the vacationing Sonny Young. Back to you, Kim.
Okay, thank you, Peter. And listen to Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, as thousands of researchers gather in Melbourne, Australia for an international meeting on HIV/AIDS, we'll hear from a young African-American gay HIV-positive man who has his own fears about seeking treatment. And researchers say they have evidence the malaria parasite lurks in bone marrow. First, some music. Here's Victoria Eluzai of Sudan with Heroes.
Oh,
Victoria Iluzai of Sudan with Heroes. Well, thousands of researchers have gathered in Melbourne, Australia for the 20th International AIDS Conference. They're sharing the latest information on issues including progress on finding a cure and treatment for the disease and co-infections caused by it. They're also looking at challenges to prevent treatment and care. This week in our special VOA Presents series, we'll look at how AIDS is affecting different groups around the world. In part one, we go to Washington, D.C., where stigma and fear keep many gay African Americans from confronting the crisis. We follow Christian Page Bass, a young gay HIV-positive man. He's had his own fears about seeking treatment as he encourages other gay men in the city to seek health services.
You got it.
I really love to sing. I think God gifted me with a talent to be able to use my voice to sing.
Christian Page Bass also likes to raise his voice with a message of inclusion.
We don't like to call ourselves a gay church. We call ourselves radically inclusive because we have transgender and we have straights or heterosexuals as well that attend the church. But I love it.
But the small town in North Carolina, where Christian grew up, was far from inclusive. In the southern U.S., conservative values are strong.
Didn't know what gay was, because the word gay was never used. The word mainly was faggot. That was the word. I didn't know anything about gays. When you're going to be a faggot, it's not you're going to be gay, you're going to be a faggot. Or you are a faggot. And I don't like that town.
In 2001, both Christian and his mother, an intravenous drug user, were diagnosed as HIV positive.
Thank you.
When she died 5 years later of complications from AIDS, Christian was gripped with fear.
I looked on the dresser, and she had already started doing her pill box for the next week. And I looked at those pills, and I remember thinking, this is going to be the death of me. And from that day forward, I didn't want to take any more pills.
In need of a change of scenery, he decided to visit some friends in Washington, D.C.
I came to D.C., and I loved it. I seen all the gay people. I just was like, I want to stay.
The big question is always, have you missed any doses in the last 3 months? Mm-hmm.
A change of scenery also changed his views of his treatment. He met Justin Goforth, a nurse practitioner at the Whitman Walker Clinic.
He was really resistant to the idea of starting treatment for HIV.
It recently broke, and
I think that he had a lot of really emotional baggage around his mother dying of HIV and the huge number of treatment and pills, really, that she was taking when she died, and now has become an advocate for people being on treatment.
Christian's advocacy has made him a regular on Washington's gay club scene.
Going to the club is work. I've had people come up to me and say, do you have a number, or do you have an email? How can I get in contact? I want to talk to you, because I was just diagnosed, or I'm dating somebody that's positive. They're there for the moment, and then they're going, and they'll call me when they need me, or they'll text me when they need me, but, you know, we keep in contact.
Christian works as a part-time model.
When I got diagnosed, and the doctor told me I had 2 years to live, I wanted to make sure people realized that you could take your medication and still be healthy and still look good and still be nice. You know, you can live long. You don't really see AIDS patients like you used to in the 80s. You use the word AIDS and everybody's running. You use the word HIV, people will stay. You use the word I'm positive and nobody's gonna move. But you use the word AIDS, it's like turning the lights on and the roach is running.
That was part one of our VOA Presents series on AIDS in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Researchers say they have evidence the malaria parasite lurks in bone marrow, a spongy tissue inside bones where blood cells are produced. As VOA's Jessica Berman reports, the discovery offers hope that new treatments can be found to fight the disease, which kills an estimated 1 million people every year.
The malaria parasite goes through a number of stages in its life cycle. After an infected mosquito bites someone, parasitic spores travel to the liver, where they grow and divide. Then they enter the bloodstream and multiply, causing the familiar symptoms of malaria: high fever, chills, sweats, fatigue, nausea, and vomiting. But there appears to be another place where immature malaria spores gather and hide: bone marrow. And once there, they can evade the body's defenses as they develop. For about 100 years, researchers have suspected a small amount of the pathogen, called Plasmodium falciparum, burrows deep inside the bones. Matt Marty specializes in malaria transmission at the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston, Massachusetts.
It was assumed that all the blood stages of the parasite are somehow sticking to the blood vessels, but these guys are not. They're outside of the blood vessels. They're in the hematopoietic system where blood is formed. And so drugs have to get there first.
But drugs have a hard time penetrating to the bone marrow, says Marty, which may explain why malaria, out of easy reach of the immune system, is difficult to treat. Investigators discovered the new reservoir of P. falciparum by studying the bone marrow of people who died of malaria. Marty says the findings may help scientists find ways to target those reservoirs during a critical stage of the parasite's life cycle.
So it will be important to find out whether the current anti-malarial therapies are efficiently targeting that site, and it will be important for new drugs to be tested whether they can target that site efficiently.
Researchers report on the role of bone marrow in malaria infection in science translational medicine. For reporter Jessica Berman, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Richard Smith, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Freedom of expression is a human right recognized by key international human rights instruments, including the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. This right may be exercised through any medium. Therefore, freedom of expression and a state's obligation or commitment to ensure this right applies online as well as offline, said U.S. State Department Attorney Advisor for Human Rights and Refugees Sabina Rajpal. Speaking at a recent Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Human Dimension meeting, Ms. Rajpal said fundamental freedoms, including freedom of expression, do not change with new technologies. Like all human rights, the right to freedom of expression inheres in the individual. It is not for governments to dole out or deny as they see fit. It is up to governments to nurture and preserve an environment in which freedom of expression, as well as other fundamental freedoms, may be exercised by their citizens. According to the United National Human Rights Committee, free, uncensored, and unhindered press or other media constitutes one of the cornerstones of a democratic society. The free communication of information and ideas about public and political issues between citizens, candidates, and elected representatives is essential. Often governments will enact laws that are overly broad and vague, open to abuse for political purposes, or lacking the judicial oversight of implementation by independent, impartial courts. Examples of cases that have had the potential to endanger freedom of expression in OSC member states include recent amendments to Kazakhstan's criminal code, Russia's restrictive laws on the internet and blogging, and moves by Turkey to block access to social media sites. The latter restrictions were lifted by recent court rulings, but the U.S. is concerned that Turkish authorities still have considerable discretion to monitor internet activity and remove content the government finds objectionable under the new internet law. The U.S. admins Rajpal will continue to raise concerns about legislation and or government action that have the potential to undermine our shared commitments to freedom of expression. The U.S. calls on participating OSCE states to meet both the letter and spirit of their commitments to protect and promote the freedom of expression and media freedom, and to reject or repeal measures that unduly restrict freedom of expression.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.